Dakota. It's A18-1515. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals.
Thank you.
You each will have 15 minutes with 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. The podium goes up and down if you want to adjust it. And as you begin your argument, would you please state your name for the record? So, counsel, are you ready to proceed? Take time to get settled. I don't mean to rush you.
No, that's fine. I think I'm ready. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Daniel Gray Leland. I represent Mr. Timothy Woodark, the appellant in this case. May it please the court, counsel. For 4 days, a jury heard testimony and reviewed exhibits in this case. For 4 days, a jury was presented with evidence that Mr. Woodark's former employer attempted to manipulate and bully him into a marriage that was the commission of felony marriage fraud. He said he wasn't going to do it, he refused to do it, and then he was fired. For 4 days, the jury heard that the respondent was intent on ruining Mr. Woodark's reputation so that he would never be able to work again. To use the owner's words, Mr. Woodark had opened the door and, quote, hell was coming through it. At the conclusion of those 4 days, the jury, in a unanimous decision, found that Lakota had retaliated against Mr. Woodark in violation of the Minnesota Whistleblower Act and discriminated against him in violation of the Minnesota Human Rights Act. The jury awarded Mr. Woodark damages, about $31,000 in lost wages to trial, and then what's at issue here is $145,600 for lost future earning capacity. That was half of what was requested in closing arguments. Despite the Minnesota Supreme Court's command to the lower courts that the amount of damages is within the particular province of the jury, in reversible error, the district court voided and nullified the award that the jury gave to my client for future earnings damages.
Mr. Leland, do you believe there's a distinction between future reduction of future earning capacity versus front pay?
That's an interesting question, because the distinction, fortunately, is not clear in the law. But I think when it was called, here it was, future earning capacity is what they were supposed to look at. And I think that's different in front pay, because it makes it more clear that the jury is supposed to consider the totality of all the circumstances, not apply, I think, some sort of rigorous idea of math, but rather to consider not what might happen the day after the trial, but what might happen, you know, the next month. The Supreme Court, it's an old case, but I think said it very eloquently. I'm trying to find it here. Well, of course, I can't find it at the moment. I'm sure I'll come into it later during my argument here. But the Minnesota Supreme Court has made it pretty clear that in considering future earning capacity, a jury can look at everything. They can look at the person's background. They can look at their age. They can look at their skills. They can look at the future problems they might have in pursuing additional employment.
Well, the judge looked at the fact that your client did find another position with the other firm and then was fired from that when she considered reducing that portion of the verdict. Do you think that makes any difference?
I think one of the critical errors there is that was the only thing that the judge considered. If you look carefully at the order, I think there's two omissions in it that are critical, critical in things that the jury considered. And the first one is what they had actually determined in this case. And that was the defendant, the respondent, had conspired to commit a federal crime and use my guy to do it. That's a critical fact here. And then the second critical fact is, we also know what the owner said he was going to do to Mr. Woodark. He wrote, I am going to ruin him criminally, financially. I'm going to make sure that he never works again. I can cause him a great deal of trouble. He's opened the door and hell's coming through it. So what the jury considered was not only, and that has to be taken into consideration with, like I said, the underlying fact that the jury had already determined that these people were going to be willing to commit federal crimes, that they were going to be manipulating and bullying people. And then they're faced with the reality of what the owner said, is I'm going after this guy until the end of time.
Is it true, Mr. Leland, then factually, the judge focused on this, that there was no evidence presented in terms of witnesses as to how he got fired at the subsequent job or why he got fired, and so the court seemed to go on that even assuming it was a proper basis, there was no evidence in any event that the jury, absent the statement that my boss said someone called. Is that not a critical fact? The judge seemed really hone in on that, that should have been presented or to even be considered, assuming, and that really is a secondary argument than perhaps the first part of the discussion, is whether the reduction of future earning capacity is a proper damage in this scenario.
Yes, and to address that, I mean, factually, that is true. We didn't have a second case about, you know, we didn't have a case within a case about what happened at his second employer, and there's obviously, you know, critical reasons for that.
So the point being, wouldn't the jury be left to speculate as to why he was discharged then, even if the issue of discharge was a relevant damage?
I think that's only one particular consideration, because I believe that future lost earnings goes beyond just that job. And I mean, clearly that is what the jury decided. I mean, a jury of seven people had the opportunity to listen to all of this, know what the employer was going to do, take the time to deliberate and consider, and that's what they decided. I think kind of gets to my point, and something that was not emphasized perhaps as much as it could have been in the brief, and that's what the jury instructions were given. So to sort of address, well, what is lost future earning capacity? What exactly does that mean? We don't have a case to tell us it's exactly this. The cases say, well, there's lots of factors to be considered. Our argument is the district court did not consider the totality of those factors.
So in making the claim, though, for lost earning capacity, the plaintiff did have the duty to mitigate, right? And he had to go out and look for another job.
Yes, and the evidence is
that, I mean, there was substantial evidence that he did exactly that.
Yeah, and there is, and that's exactly what he did.
So you're not quibbling with that statement of law, I don't think, are you?
I think the one quibble that I do have with that, and it's kind of at the end of the brief, it's this issue about the affirmative defenses, and they didn't plead loss of mitigation as a failure, as an affirmative defense. It was never pled. It wasn't even pled after trial.
Was the jury instructed on the duty to mitigate? I mean, I realize the issue is not in front of me, so I'm just asking
sure.
As a matter of your knowledge.
I don't have it right in front of me, but I believe they were. I mean, they were given the jury's instructions, and that's kind of how I started.
I mean, if the jury was given that instruction, and the record will bear that out, I mean,
yes.
That's the law of the case here. It also seems to be an accurate statement of Minnesota law. I think to make a loss of future earning capacity claim, a plaintiff does need to attempt to mitigate those damages by going out to seek a job, which we, again, you offered ample evidence that that's what happened here.
Yes. I
guess what confuses me about your argument is why not focus on the fact that he did obtain a new job and was subsequently discharged from that new job. I think that's Prairie Wild, isn't that right?
backwards, Wild Prairie.
Wild Prairie,
yes,
there you go, one or the other. Because we don't know why he was discharged from that other job, at that point, doesn't it cut off damages?
No, I don't think
and
there's...
And why not? Give me a case that says that it wouldn't.
I can, and I was attempting to find that case. I think Wilson v. Sorge, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, it appears at page 17 of our brief. And that says, it is within the province of the jury to weigh all these elements and guided by experience and common sense to arrive at the proper monetary value of plaintiff's loss without recourse to his past earnings.
Well, I think you need to do a little more than that, though, counsel. Don't you have to give us a rationale that would support, a record that would support the jury's determination for a loss of future earning capacity? Well, it can't just be a magical, the jury considered everything. It's got to be something more than that, right?
I don't know if that would necessarily, I don't know if I agree with that. You know, the
okay,
question
then tell
is
me why.
To say that it stops right now, well, you know, it stops at some certain time. There's no case that says that.
No. I didn't mean to imply that that would be a hard and fast rule. I just meant let me just back up for a second. I guess what I'm trying to understand is what record supports the jury's determination of the amount of lost earning capacity, the amount of damages that it awarded? How does it get to that number? I'm sure you had a rationale for it in your closing argument.
I had a rationale for
it. And it was a greater
it.
Number, obviously.
We did not have special interrogatory answers to the jury, so I don't know. We don't have the record of why they made that decision.
But you made an argument, and you based it on the evidence, right?
Yes.
And what was the evidence you relied on?
Certainly. The argument that was made was that Mr. Woodruff has been out of work. We know we have an employer who has conspired to commit a felony crime involving him, that has said they're going to try and make sure that he never works again and to ruin him, and made the argument, well, if that is really what they want to do, then let's give Mr. Woodruff his damages through the time of retirement. And now the rough calculation on that was 7 years. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying the jury came up with 3.5 years, but that's the math. Mm-hmm. And like I said, we don't have... unfortunately, special interrogatories to maybe flesh it out a little bit. But I think, I mean, to not overemphasize the point, I think the district court needs to have faith in the jury and their ability to consider all of these matters. The jury considered, the jury instructions, no one claims that they were flawed. 4 different times they were instructed, at least 4. How the little box in which they could be awarding damages and everything that they were supposed to consider. You know, and after their deliberation, that's what they determined. And I don't think it's appropriate, I don't think it's proper for a district court to tell 7 jurors that they're wrong.
Mr. Leland, to flip that then, is it safe to say then, by that, let's assume that math indeed was the calculation because you had made an argument to that extent, that they concluded through retirement he has no capacity to work or earn income?
Again,
caused by the discharge, caused by the wrongful discharge.
You know, and I'd always hazard a guess to speculate. I mean, it could have been... he's going to be out of work for 3.5 years. I mean, that would be the exact math. Or he's going to be at a diminished earning capacity for some period of time. That more or less is going to come out to about the equivalent of 3.5 years, half of what was asked for through to retirement.
But the only reason I'm asking, is that not the obligation of the trial judge in the post-trial motion? Was there sufficient evidence for the jury to have concluded as a matter of law that dollar amount for that type of damage?
Well, I mean, they determine it as a matter of fact. And if it's a matter of fact, the judge needs to apply a clearly erroneous standard. Was there evidence in the record to support that? Certainly. I think this is, you know, I don't want to overemphasize the same points. We have a narrow issue here, I guess. But this is an employer who said they were out to get the guy. The jury got to witness all of that for 4 days. Looking at a stale record of it now, it might be easier to draw certain conclusions. But the conclusions that, you know, the proper conclusions were determined by seven people pulled from Hennepin County who got to listen to everything, view everything, see the witnesses, see how they responded, see when they got angry, see how they acted. And so arriving at this, you know, equivalent of 3.5 years, you know, as we set forth in our brief, there isn't strict mathematical accuracy to this. It's always, there's always going to be questions. You can't always, you know, calculate it down to a penny. But the jury did attempt to apply numbers, I think, in the most basic way that they could. And I just want to emphasize one thing, seeing that my time is running out. This wasn't some crazy runaway jury who is awarding the guy millions of dollars for stuff, who just, it just shocks the conscience when you hear what happened here. He was awarded not very much at the end of the day, a whole lot less than certainly we asked for. And it was about the equivalent of about 4 years of pay. So just, I would like to close, you know, my time is up. I think that should be considered in determining. I'll just leave it there, thank you.
Yeah, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Brian Kidwell, and I am the attorney for the respondent, Lakota Inc., in this matter. I think the appellant and the respondent are in agreement on one thing in this case, at least, and that is there's a singular issue presented to this court. Each of us have a singular issue in our briefs. I state the issue this way in my brief. Did the trial court err when it determined that, as a matter of law, the appellant was not entitled to recover any damages for future lost earning capacity? The appellant frames the issue slightly different, and he asks whether the district court erred in reducing the jury verdict in the amount of $145,600 in lost earning capacity to zero. And from that statement, he goes on to cite case law about how it's the peculiar province of the jury to determine the amount of damages, and should those determinations should only be interfered with when the failure to do so would be shocking or result in a plain injustice. But, Your Honors, this is not a case in which the trial judge substituted her judgment for the judgment of the jury as to the amount of damages. This is a case in which the trial judge determined, as a matter of law, that there was no evidence on which a reasonable jury could determine that the appellant would suffer any future wage loss. That, and this is the critical part, that was the natural, usual, and necessary result of the discriminatory termination that the jury found occurred. That's the law. That's pretty simple, unless you can make that causal connection between the discriminatory termination of the appellant's employment by Lakota. He's not entitled to recover those damages that he seeks. Now, in making this determination, Judge Miller noted a number of specific things. First, not only was Mr. Wodark found to be able to find comparable employment, but he, in fact, did so. And, Your Honors, the case law on front pay is overwhelmingly clear. That's a critical conclusion.
So Judge Sleater asked Mr. Leland if there's a difference between front pay and future lost earning capacity. Could you answer that question also?
I can, Your Honor. And I'll do it in two fashions. One, I think it's important for the court to take note of Judge Miller's statement that the appellant at trial presented no evidence that it was the termination of his employment by Lakota that prevented him from finding employment after he was terminated by Wild Prairie. So that's the one thing I would say, is that to the extent that we have a more generalized concept of impairment of future earning capacity. It's the burden of the party seeking damages for that to provide to present evidence. Judge Miller determined that he did not. But more importantly, the case law on front pay is overwhelmingly clear. When you're claiming damages that go into the future, it has to be the natural consequence of the unlawful termination. We now have irrefutable evidence that notwithstanding the termination of the appellant's employment by Lakota, he was able to find a comparable job. Something happened in the interim. None of us today know what that was. But he got himself fired a second time. And the case law is clear. Unless he can prove that somehow or other Lakota was responsible for that firing, he's not entitled to future damages based on that. So I think there may be somewhere in the law a difference between front pay and the more generalized concept of impairment of future earning capacity. But when you have a situation where the party claiming an impairment of future earning capacity has in fact found comparable employment, I think it's a distinction without much of a difference in the law. Judge Miller noted in her decision that while Mr. Wodark suspected that Lakota was responsible for him being terminated by Wild Prairie, he offered, and she used the term, no evidence in support of those suspicions. I think that's actually a fair statement. We have a situation where he offers hearsay testimony that his boss said something to him. We don't know who that boss was, and we don't know that the boss even knew what the complaints about him were. We do know that Mr. Wodark never asked what they were. We don't even know who answered the alleged phone calls. It wasn't the boss, apparently. He said somebody called Wild Prairie, and somebody else apparently answered the phone call. So we're now building a case of hearsay within hearsay. It is, frankly, rather shocking. And I asked myself, I wasn't the counsel at the trial of this case, but I've been trying cases for the better part of 40 years, and I asked myself, if I was trial counsel and I wanted to prove impairment of future earning capacity, and I knew that one of my responsibilities, that's the lion's share of damages here, even under the $145,000 for future earning and the $35,000, or roughly $35,000 for past damages, we're talking about over 80% of the total damages being claimed. According to the argument made at trial, it was way more than 90%. And if I was going to try and prove that at trial, I ask myself, if it was my burden to prove a causal connection between termination of my client's employment and that the defendant was responsible for that, would I fail to call the only people with knowledge of those circumstances? If it was my burden to prove that, and it is, that's the law, you have to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that the future damages are reasonably likely to occur. If that was my burden, under what circumstances might I fail to put that in my pleading, because it's not in the complaint, to make a claim for special damages, because it's not in the wherefore clause for special damages, to not disclose as potential witnesses at trial the only people who actually know why Mr. Wodark was filed by Wild Prairie? Under what circumstances might I do that? And I've asked myself that question, and Your Honor, the answer is there isn't a good reason. There are some really bad reasons, but there aren't any good reasons, because you have a duty to notify the opposing party in fairness under the notice pleading rules what your claims are, and there's nothing in the record in this case that shows the appellant notified Lakota and its counsel that he intended to make a claim that Lakota should pay damages based on the termination of Mr. Woodark's employment at Wild Prairie. Nothing. The record is absolutely devoid of that.
Mr. Now, was that include front pay damage remedy sought? Is there not a request for front pay?
There is, Your Honor.
And the part of the reason I'm raising that is because there is this, there appears to be an argument that's synonymous, and so the point being, even though the jury instruction was earning capacity, and that's what the verdict form, the complaint, and now the discussion, some of the case law is focusing on front pay. That's part of why we've been asking that question of the distinction. So to get to your point, was that was indeed truly alleged? And
it
your
was,
point being is if the evidence had been presented as to why the discharge at the Wild Prairie occurred, and indeed if it confirms the inference based on the threats, I guess, that were made by the owner, would that not then be sufficient and be on a valid remedy at that stage from your standpoint?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, the bare allegation, and it's in the complaint, a right to front pay. That bare allegation doesn't put my client on notice that there are some unique circumstances associated with the claim that somehow or other Lakota or Natalia Kelly, who's the owner of Lakota, or Patrick Kelly, who's her husband, were directly responsible for Mr. Woodark's termination. That's an extraordinary claim. And it deserves to be alleged specifically in a pleading, as Judge Miller noted. That goes way beyond the claim that was made in this case, and it was never asserted. That's number one. Number two, there were interrogatories propounded by Lakota to Mr. Woodark and his counsel that asked specifically, tell me who has knowledge regarding any of the claims in this case. And nobody at Wild Prairie was identified. They were asked to specifically identify, and this is really important. They were asked to specifically itemize their damages. There's no reference in the response to those, in the answers to interrogatories, an itemization of damages arising from the termination of Mr. Woodark's employment at Wild Prairie. It's completely absent. Counsel has a duty to supplement answers to interrogatories. So I ask myself, why might you not call these people or put Lakota on notice that, by the way, we're making this claim? And there isn't a good answer. There isn't a good reason. I can't say that counsel acted in this manner with the intent to engage in litigation by ambush. I can tell you, however, and I've read the record, I wasn't trial counsel, but I've read the record, that was the result. The result was a claim for almost all the damages that were being asserted was hidden until the time of trial, and then it was presented by hearsay testimony with no attempt, despite the fact that Wild Prairie is a local employer, and the individuals involved live locally. They were subject to the subpoena power of the court, and it wasn't exercised. We think there's a reason that happened. It's too late to prove that because we didn't get notice that we might want to talk to those people prior to trial. But I think that's a very interesting question. We have a situation, Your Honors, where what Mr. Woodark and his counsel want this court to do is to believe all of the nasty things that they've said about Patrick Kelly and his wife, and assume that somehow or other they acted in accordance with that when they made these phone calls to Wild Prairie that resulted in his termination of his employment at Wild Prairie. That's a huge speculative leap. That is not an inference, Your Honors, from the evidence presented at trial. That's idle speculation. The suggestion that because Patrick Kelly said some things in the heat of anger that indicated that he didn't like Mr. Woodark one little bit doesn't constitute proof that he was responsible for making those calls. We do not even know, based on the record, what was alleged in those calls, whether it was completely factually accurate or not. Because Mr. Wodark says, no, I never asked what was said. We don't know who made the calls because there's never been an investigation into that. The jury apparently believed the speculation. They weren't entitled to do so. Judge Miller is correct in making that determination. It is the responsibility of the trial judge to require that only reasonable inferences from the evidence presented are made by the jury and not speculation. That's what happened here, Your Honors. We don't believe that the judge made an error. In fact, she did precisely the job that a trial judge is charged to do and required that the jury enter a verdict only on the basis of the claims actually asserted and only on the basis of the evidence actually presented. Her order granting the judgment as a matter of law that was filed by Lakota post-trial was correct, and it should be affirmed.
Thank you. Mr. Leland, any rebuttal?
Thank you again, Daniel Leland, appearing on behalf of the appellant in this case. There's just a couple of things that I was hoping to be able to clarify from counsel's argument here. I'm not arguing that there is a problem about a reduction as front pay wages. It's not my argument. My argument is that the judge nullified, voided, what a jury was doing. I think, you know, counsel asked, well, if I was going to prove it at trial, this is what I would do. This is what I would do. The fact of the matter is, we did prove it at trial. And that's why a jury came forward after careful deliberations, after appropriate jury instructions, and found that the way that they did. You know, this idea that any sort of employment case is going to result in some bleak house litigation that's going to constantly involve people suing one another, you know, about whatever, Wild Prairie, whatever else might be the case. That can't be the status of the law. We're not going to have trials within trials for every case that we bring before the court. I'm sure Judge Miller would not have been happy if we had tried to do that. You know, in terms of the speculation, in terms of what I litigated the case below and speculation in terms of how that case was litigated. I mean, what I can say is, if I was litigating a case that was going forward, I'd probably depose the plaintiff. And in this case, they chose not to depose the plaintiff, which I think is would have explained a lot of things that they're perhaps now claiming about, at least to depose any witness, but they did not. And then I was, I kind of missed this. I kept talking about it, but really haven't got there because it is a point that I do want to emphasize, which is the jury instructions. And as I've indicated, they are, you know, there are four specific limitations that the judge said. I mean, there's a neat little box in which they had to consider all the evidence, and that's what they did. Counsel speculates, well, they must have believed that the Kellys called and did all this stuff and said all these horrible things about us. Well, that's speculation about what the jury did. We don't know. And I don't think it's necessarily fair to attribute all of the lost future earnings or front pay. I understand there might be an issue about that. Based upon the termination from Wild Prairie. I mean, I think that's argued perhaps ad nauseum in our briefing, and so I might leave it at that. I did find one case that I did want to draw the court's attention to because it's kind of mentioned sort of in passing in our brief, but it's at page 24, and it's the Snow v. Pillsbury case. It is a District of Minnesota case from 1986, 650 F sub 299, where the court basically said interim earnings aren't going to offset anything. And I think, you know, when you look at the cases and the logic that they apply, like Snow v. Pillsbury, I'd encourage you to read the logic because I think it just makes sense. Beyond that, yeah, I just finally have to say yes. I want to emphasize that I don't think the jury had to speculate and believe that these things happen with Wild Prairie or not. I mean, the question is, what's going to happen after Wild Prairie? What would be happening during Wild Prairie? If he was working at Wild Prairie, he's making less money, he still gets awarded front pay damages for that. If he's not making his commissions at Wild Prairie that he's hoping to make, if he's making less money, he should be awarded damages for that. If he would have been making more money, if he hadn't been illegally terminated in retaliation, he probably would have been making money, more money over the course of time when he was at Lakota. And the jury was very specifically instructed on this. Quite frankly, I mean, I thought it was overkill. The jury was instructed that the damages must be a direct result of the decision to terminate, that the future loss earning capacity must be attributable to his discharge to Lakota, that they could not engage in speculation, guess, or conjecture, and could not award damages out of sympathy or for punishment, and that he was required to prove the nature, extent, duration, and consequences of his harm. Now, there's a lot of discussion about, well, what should have happened, what could have happened. The fact of the matter is we know what happened, and a jury listened to all the evidence, and they made a decision in terms of awarding Mr. Wardick front pay. We would therefore respectfully request, I'll see if there's questions, but that the court's order with respect to the front pay lost future earning capacity be reversed, and we just reinstate the jury verdict, and then we have some confidence in the jury system. Unless there's questions, I will waive the rest of my time.
Thank you very much. We will have our order out within the 90 days.
Thank you.
And that concludes the oral part of our calendar. We're going to recess and go consider our non-oral cases now. Please rise.
Mr. Kidwell?